Just a thought. So, say Paul, the Apostle Paul, had a tumor that was in that critical part of his brain,
yeah,
which allows him to be totally weird. So, if Christ and the Holy Spirit aren't indwelling enough in a person, and they get some kind of pathology there, would they not be a mass murderer like Whitcomb or
Whitman?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is we don't know, because Paul didn't have one of those that we know of. So we don't know if by the time he was done. Remember, he said, I've finished the course in 2 Timothy 4, chapter 4. He said, I have finished the course. I've run the race. I finished the course. Henceforth is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, and not for me only, but for all of those who love his appearing. My guess would be we wouldn't see any. Some people who get, there is a possibility that some people get the frontotemporal dementia who continue to act in ways which are not bizarre and antisocial, but we wouldn't know they had it, would we? Mm-hmm. Because they would just be more quiet and docile and more forgetful. Mm-hmm. Not everybody who gets dementia gets violent. So, but I hate to go further than that, because we're getting into an area that we really don't know a lot about, because it is the unconscious mind, and it's hard to get down there, and it's hard to do science on it, although Freud would tell you it has to do with your relationship with your mother at an early age and father, and Jung would tell you it has to do with dreams and the primitive self, and then you have Horney and all these other different people who use the same idea of an unconscious mind, but they tweak it. I was in psychology before I decided to go into medicine. And it was when I had to take my theories of personality class, I had to read a book on every one of these 13 major personality theorists. I enjoyed B.F. Skinner's, which had to do with operant conditioning, and that everything is simply cause and effect and chemicals in your brain. And if you know where all the chemicals are, you can predict what the patient's going to think and what they're going to do. Why that's lost a lot of steam now is because operant conditioning does not cure everything, and because we also learned about something called the quantum mechanics, which bring in an uncertainty to everything that happens at a chemistry level, at a biochemistry level. So, but in answer to your question, that's a good one. I don't know the answer, but I'm guessing that there would be some people who would have their unconscious, who had been walking with God all along, who might have their unconscious be just fine if you blotted out the neocortex. And we know that Elijah and Enoch would have definitely fit that bill.
So, Bob, you know, I spend way too many hours of my life dealing with people with addictions.
Yeah.
It's my water and breathing 8 hours a day at the VA hospital, and I have a question for you and then a comment of how I usually describe to my 10th grade reasoning level patients, right, as easily as I think I can get it to them to understand why they can't just say, oh, I'm going to quit drinking, oh, I'm just going to decide to stop smoking, oh, I'm, right, and we always know there's always a spectrum of low risk to high risk in these areas of someone with addictive disorders. But when you say your unconscious mind, I describe to my patients that the outer shell of the thalamus, the lateral portions of the thalamus is where we have our dopamine reward pathway initiated. And then it goes forward with the release of dopamine and norepinephrine through nicotine to create a sensation that they come to believe is normal for them. It's actually abnormal, and it stresses the brain. All addictions stress the brain, right? So, and then the consequence of having a stressed brain is you go into withdrawal, because you were never supposed to release that many chemicals in that way, right? And crack cocaine is the worst for immediacy. So I tell them, and I'd love to have you rephrase it with what you've just done. I tell them, so what you have allowed to happen by the choices you made when you were 12 or 15 or 18 when you joined the Marines is you allowed a substance to create a pathway in your brain that creates sensations, feelings, and emotions that you now come to believe are normal, and that when those sensations go away, you go empty, the chemicals go down, and you go empty, you've got to fill yourself back up again, and that's why you need to smoke 20, 30, 40, 50 times a day. And that has to do with your genetics, 70% of which you don't have any choice of how your genetics made you dependent on dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, GABA, right? Dopamine, epinephrine. So I can't predict what you're deficient in, but what I know is you're using tobacco to fix something that's wrong, either an environmental change in you or a genetic change in you says that you don't have enough dopamine genetically, and you used nicotine to just make your brain feel normal, your interpretation of normal. And when you come to me and say, why can't I quit? I've tried so many times, I just can't stay quit. What I tell them is, well, you've allowed the stupid part of your brain, your lower brainstem, you've allowed the stupid part of your brain to tell the smart part of your brain through the release of dopamine, hey, this feels really good, whatever my body just did, let's remember that so we can do it again when I feel bad. And so it's that whole dopamine reward pathway and the release of dopamine that makes you go search out lighters and cigarettes and go to where you can give yourself another hit, because you've allowed yourself to be controlled by the bottom of your brain, the stupid part of your brain. Can you give me some terminology of how I can interpret that with what you said?
Well, I'm going to throw I'm going to add just a few medical terms to that, and maybe that will or won't help you. The nucleus accumbens is where you have the pleasure noted. And there's always, it's a dopamine 2 receptor. And the VTA, which is ventral tegmental area, is what brings in the stuff from the thalamic area and consolidates it to give the zing to the nucleus accumbens. Now, the nucleus accumbens, and all of this, by the way, everything that we've just discussed is in what the parts of the brain which are clearly inhabited by the subconscious or the unconscious part of the brain. You have no capability of getting down there and saying, hey, let's rearrange this. Now, those who have a genetic...
So do drugs rearrange this? You just said you have no ability to change that.
Yes, they do.
Drugs rearrange that.
Especially cocaine, especially... And heroin, when you get the first hit with heroin, it actually changes a vast number of circuitry in your brain that feed into, eventually, the nucleus accumbens. All right? And the brain that changes itself by Deutsch talks about this in depth. If you want to look it up, he really gives it to you what happens. Now, a whole new circuitry is multiple circuits are made in your brain, and it's a one-time imprinting because the amygdala has such a charge that it gets when the nucleus accumbens triggers that it, along with the hippocampus, makes it a permanent memory. But it's a memory you can't recall. It's not a memory of an event. It's a memory of how you get to that high again. Yeah. You see what I mean? It's a pathway. Mm-hmm. The VTA has delta-fos-B living in it. And delta-fos-B is what gives you the longing. It brings to your memory. It triggers the circuits. So you say, oh, it's cigarette smoking. That's what really did it for me. I know that now. I mean, I remember that. And then delta-fos-B provides the longing, the the lusting, that I've got to have it now, even if I know that doing this is absolutely killing me. And you can see people that I see all the time that have had both their legs cut off to here, and now we're having, you know, we're taking all the other limbs off too, and they're using what they've got left to smoke, and they know very well that the smoking is what caused all of this in the first place. But what happens when this pathway gets triggered is the neocortex is shut off, completely turned down. So you can't, there's no voice saying, well, you know that that cigarette is what caused you to lose your legs. You don't think about that. That gets blotted out. And for a brief period of time, they don't have any conception that that's what's happened. They don't think about it. It's not an issue to them. All they can think about is getting that cigarette and this gnawing drive in them to get the cigarette to quiet it down. So the imprinting, and he uses the word, Deutsch calls it the word imprinting, that comes when you get a massive discharge at the nucleus accumbens, will make for addictions which are extremely difficult and resistance to be removed. My personal opinion, without God coming in and working at a biochemical level, there is no way you're going to evoke that to happen. And that's why in Isaiah 42 and Isaiah 61, where it says, you've let the prisoners out of the prison house. Here, and in Ezekiel 28, it says, when talking about the devil at the end, when all the nations come and look and say, is this the guy that caused all the problems? Is this the guy who never let any of his prisoners out? So it's this mechanism. Now, why are people susceptible? Well, one theory that I really buy into, and I believe there's pretty good evidence for, is that the dopamine 2 receptors in their nucleus accumbens are defective. And so what happens when the normal amount of dopamine goes over, it can't trigger the receptor. And so these people never feel good about themselves. And what they'll tell you is, when I had that first drink, I felt normal. I felt alive. I said, this must be what everybody else is talking about. Or when they have the cigarette, again, I feel like everybody else. Life is good. I've never felt this way before. Now, the problem is, in heroin, you go down the line. The problem is that when these non-endorphin triggering agents trigger the dopamine 2 receptor, they further change its conformation to make it less receptive to your normal endorphins. Meaning that when the high goes away, you get a real low. Cocaine, if you have someone who hasn't had cocaine for a little while that's used to taking it, they are depressed. They are very slow. People who don't get a cigarette, because the vagus nerve is often the big recipient of that to trigger, and it eventually gets to the nucleus accumbens, it calms you down. So you see people who need a smoke, they start shaking. It's unopposed sympathetic. Now, of interest is Delta-Fos-B is responsible, they feel now, for both anxiety and fear. In mice, if you eliminate Delta-Fos-B after an adult mice, it doesn't get anxious and it loses all fear. What does Christ say over and over again? Don't be afraid. And what else does he say? The peace I give to you is not as the world gives. You bet. The world gives it to you by having a cigarette. Christ is saying, I'm going to take that Delta-Fos-B and I'm going to box it up and I'm going to put an antidote. And I'm sure the way he does it is probably with microRNAs, because John 15 and the vine tells us, if you follow that parable and look at a scientific equivalent, it is microRNAs. We don't have time to talk about that tonight. So Christ can deliver. These are literal statements that he's saying. A lot of us go, oh, well, sure, of course God always gives us peace. I'm sure it's good peace. But what he's saying is, no, it's real peace. And as my exhibit A, when I read this as a kid, it just impressed me, and it has continually, when I read about it, early on Acts, early in Acts, in the book of Acts, after the disciples have the day of, right after Pentecost, where they go out and 3,000 are one in one day, are baptized. The next day they're brought in because they're out preaching again, and they arrest Peter. Remember that? And they put Peter in prison because they said, we can't kill him right today because there's such a big crowd out there. We're going to get a riot on our hands. But we'll kill him tomorrow. We'll have a quiet, secret tribunal, and we'll give him one more chance to recant, because we know he was a fraidy cat. He wouldn't even talk to the gal who was at the door of Caiaphas' house. If we can't bowl him over, we're going to kill him. Peter knows they're going to kill him the next day. Now, if that were me, I would be down in the dungeon, I'm sure, with my eyes like this, going over, praying, and what am I going to do, and this is terrible. What's Peter doing? So hard that the angel has to shake him a couple of times to wake him up. That is peace. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, and then he can't believe he's getting up. That's what we're talking about here.
And you're saying God gives that to us through microRNA?
I believe, well, microRNAs can do it. Whether he does that with microRNAs, I don't know for positive. But they can shut down the, it's called C-FOS, which is the protein coding area. Mm-hmm. They can shut it down. We know microRNAs can shut down any protein coding area. And we know by reading the story of the vine and the branches and the grafting, putting a scion on, we know that everything that's described in John 15 is microRNAs that come from the stem and go up through the phloem into the part of the plant that's grafted on. We know that. We can prove that. And Christ says that we are to dwell in him. He's the stem and we're the branches. And that it's like this. Well, I don't think Christ just picks something out of the something he saw there and says, I'll use that as an example. I think he knew that today you and I would be able to go in and see exactly how grafting a diseased branch onto a healthy stem that has acquired a resistance to the tobacco mosaic virus or to the tomato virus, the microRNAs can come to the grafted part, and now it either makes the tobacco leaf as it was originally planned, or it starts producing tomatoes, which it won't do when the virus is active. But you take it off of the stem and put it back on its original stem, and it dies. It actually dies, and he says that in the story, and is picked off and burned. So the Bible tells us, if you're willing to dig down and look at the science, I believe it's given great direction and where to look and how things work. This isn't mystery anymore. And I can tell you that in rats, how do they knock it out? They knock it out with microRNA. So why, if we can do that in a rat, don't you think maybe God could do that? The guy who thought this whole thing up? I do. We do it. Don't you think he can? And wouldn't that be a logical way, because we know it works? And it works well. I mean, in these mice, you can reproduce this. So, yes, that's why I believe it. It's not me just saying, I'm going to throw some medical terms at you, and maybe you'll just believe me. Because, you don't want to look it up yourself, and it sounds good. Dr. Webster and I have almost 15,000 peer review articles that we have archived, that we have read at least portions of, all dealing with genetics and the Bible. There is more than an ample evidence to back up everything I've just said in real papers, many of them from very prominent journals like Nature and Science and Genetics, Genomics, and PNAS, and on and on and on. So the Bible is, I believe, a science book. And I know that people who have heard me say that laugh to my face and laugh probably many more behind my back. But after I've read all of those journals and I've looked and compared it with biblical texts, and the biblical texts tell us where to look, or Ellen White tells us where to look. She doesn't know she's telling us, but she puts statements in there, and we say, well, that, in order for that to be true, we have to go here and look here, and sure enough, we find it. I'll just give you one quick example. She said in the antediluvian world, the reason the devil was able to take them in so few generations from Adam, who was able to commune with his creator in perfect, and I use the word holiness, meaning that he was whole, to the antediluvians less than 2,000 years later that need to be destroyed. And we gave you the text at the beginning that their thoughts were evil continuously. And that's where I introduced the fact that the subconscious is where most of your thoughts originate from, and that your conscious mind just picks the ones that it wants to deal with. And you may get 5 or 6 different suggestions for you to think about and work on at a time, and your brain will pick out the one it wants to. But and the antediluvians, all of them were bad suggestions. So given that, where was I going with this? What did I just said before? Oh, the yes. Oh, how did you get them down? Thank you. She makes... She, yeah, well, really, but one, but we'll give the others some shadow of the doubt. Well, let's throw Ham out too. So we'll say 8. She said it was through 2 things: eating of flesh food and drinking of alcohol. So I said to Mike, let's look this up. If either it's true or it's not true, and we've got to be able to find some very good evidence that strongly addresses this directly. And we did. Multiple papers. Eating meat increases your desire for alcohol for openers, but meat is something called an acetylating agent, and an acetylating agent goes into the cells of your body, both neuron and somatic, and it makes the chromatin, remember the DNA chromosomes that are bound by proteins called histones, and they're bound up, they're locked up in these proteins. It's kind of like you put an insulator jacket around it and wind a rope around it and tie it so you can't get in and transcribe it. When you give an acetylating agent, it unlocks it, so those areas which have been locked up, called heterochromatin, and makes them readable. And that's called, now it becomes euchromatin. The vast percentage, if not, I've never seen anyone actually quantitate it, but the people all say the vast percentage of heterochromatin is covering up mobile genetic elements and protein-coded areas which have oncogenes in them and have other very, very bad actors. So you see, when you eat meat, why do you get cancer? Because you're uncovering the areas that have your body has gone to great lengths to cover up. You've uncovered oncogenes. They're now available to be read. Will they be read? We don't know, but they're now available to be read. But guess what else it does? It uncovers certain mobile genetic elements which drive bad brain circuitry. And part of the circuitry that is driven is delta-fos-B. Because you get addicted to the taste of blood, that's delta-fos-B. Now delta-fos-B is coming in on this. Alcohol is a big driver for delta-fos-B and the delta in the dopamine 2 receptor in the nucleus accumbens. So when you're eating flesh foods, you are now in greatly increasing your ability to become addicted. Mm-hmm. And it also increases your desire for alcohol. And guess what? The opposite is true. One paper shows that people who have two strong drinks before dinner eat way more, always order red meat and eat way more of it. And they have actually done double-blind studies which show that alcohol predisposes you to eating raw red meat. That's why they want you to have two drinks before you come in. They want you to sit at the bar. You're more likely. And then after you've had that red meat, you're driven to more alcohol. So, was Ellen White's statement right? It sure could have been. It makes sense. Because the material which God in His mercy has put into the heterochromatin, you're loosing it. You're letting it free. So I gave that as an example. That's far afield from where we were tonight. But to show that even, I figured when I read that statement, that one would probably, we would be unsuccessful in proving that. And if I was someone who is challenging the position that I was taking, that's definitely one I'd put front and center. And I'm totally convinced now, she's spot on right. We've done that to others too, which other positions she's taken, I should say, but I, you know, it's 8:15, so, yeah.
Dairy products? Are you including that with meat or separate?
Dairy products have a separate area on their own. Dairy products are very high in neuraminic acid 5-GC. What is neuraminic acid 5-GC? Well, all mammals have a pathway where they make neuraminic acid 5-GC, except for humans. We have a mobile genetic element which has incapacitated the last chemical Thank you. I was trying to keep this in a less than too. I've been criticized as being too scientific. So if you've noticed, I have gone to great lengths to leave the science out. Have you noticed that?
Yes. So finish the sentence. We have a mobile genetic unit that incapacitates
The conversion of neuraminic acid 5-AC to neuraminic acid 5-GC, which means an acetyl group to a glycol group on the 5 sugar of the neuraminic acid, the 5 carbon of the sugar.
And that does what?
Okay, if you look at a cell, you're going to find that it has what I call a totem pole on the outside of a cell. And it has these glycoproteins, of which neuraminic acid is one, and they all are stacked up. And the code there is read by the T4 lymphocytes that come along every so often, and they're checking on the age of the cell, that the cell belongs to you, that the cell is still functioning well. And by the way, cells that are beginning to develop cancer are supposed to put out a little sign out there in this totem pole or right next to it that says, I'm not doing well. Bad things are happening in here, and the T cell marks it, and then the lymphocytes come in and destroy it. Or the T cell will inject in a code into the cell that says, undergo apoptosis right now, which means cell disassembly and the parts are then used by other cells. Okay? They're killer cells. So what happens is with this totem pole, is that's where a lot of this is coded. But the end codon is always neuraminic acid. In humans, it's 5-AC. In animals, it's 5-GC. When you eat a mammal, red meat,
or dairy,
particularly
cheese,
which is a high concentration, and Ellen White says cheese is unfit for human consumption, and she's right. And I'm going to remind me to tell you about mTOR. Someone remind me to tell you about mTOR, because I'm going to keep down this path, and you're going to have to remind me. Okay, what happens with this neuraminic acid GC? It's out there as an end codon. When you eat red meat, and especially if it's red, meaning you got blood in there, you are going to get a huge dose of neuraminic acid 5-GC. There are macrotransmitters in your colon, in your intestine, usually up in the jejunum area, which take in total large pieces of the protein that you've ingested and take them into your bloodstream unchanged. I know everyone thinks that when I eat something, the acid in my stomach breaks it down to the atoms. It would be of no use to you if that were the case. It doesn't do that. The acid is there primarily to kill bacteria and other pathogens, some viruses. It's a way to try to cleanse what's coming into the system. So when it's taken across by these macro transporters, it gets into the bloodstream and it hooks on to different proteins, but as it's going by, the endothelium of cells will reach out, because they have access, they're the first ones as the meal goes by before it goes to the liver, and they say, we'll have some of that, and they pull it in. And they've actually got, in a couple of papers I have where they actually diagram how it's taken into the cell. The cell can't tell the difference between neuraminic acid 5-GC or AC. All it can tell you is it's neuraminic acid. And so it goes into a Golgi apparatus where it's cleaned off, taken off of the other stuff it came on. And then it's put right back out on the cell. It's utilized because it being the end codon at the end of that totem pole, it gets broken off all the time. And so the cell has to replenish it a lot. So it's looking for a neuraminic acid 5-AC, but it can't tell the difference, so it puts a GC out there. But guess what? The T4 lymphocyte that comes along says, invader! It can tell the difference between an AC and a GC, and it says, call in the killer cells, call in the mast cells, call in... This is an apoptosis thing. This is a destroy this thing right now, because we're being invaded. It's probably a bacterium. So guess what happens? How do you get an atherosclerotic plaque? You kill the cells. There's a denuding that occurs. Before the fibroblasts even come in, the low-density lipoproteins come by, and they like to lodge in there, and then the fibroblasts come over, and now you've got the first set. Then this happens again, and you add them more, and then more and more, and pretty soon you're going to occlude. That's why eating red meat or eating cheese is going to promote atherosclerosis. It's not a mystery. So, milk is especially rich not only in neuraminic acid 5-GC, but it has another neat characteristic. It's loaded with microRNAs that comes from the mother cow that's going to the baby cow that says, put weight on right here. You need a strong pelvic area so that you can move and put on weight. Add muscle, but add fat. And those microRNAs are no different than the microRNAs in your cells that would tell you to do that. So all this information is coming in. What do you think is going to happen? It affects your DNA just like the cow. The baby calf's DNA is affected by that from what the mother gives them. And you're drinking it 3 times a day? Now, here's a third reason, and I'll stop here. We could keep going. And that's something called mTOR, that's mechanistic target of rapamycin. Go look it up.
Mammalian target of rapamycin.
Well, it's also called mechanistic, and then there's four different names for it. Thank you for you gave me a chance to discuss that. There is mechanistic. There is okay.
It's a target for a lot of the drugs that treat cancer.
So say it again, mechanistic.
mTOR, look under little m, capital T-O-R.
Target?
Of rapamycin. Branch is absolutely correct. It's what drives cancer cells. If it's not turned on, you don't get any cancer. Because it drives the cell. It's like a thyroid does to a normal cell. mTOR does this to the cell to make it do what it normally does. But especially divide. And what triggers it is something called the branched chain amino acids, of which isoleucine is the primary one that is a receptor on the outside of the cell membrane that, when triggered, activates mTOR. If you didn't have mTOR, you wouldn't have diabetes type 2, because it would drive the pancreatic, all of a sudden my mind's blanking, on the pancreatic beta cells. It drives them to produce a lot of insulin, and they keep making insulin until they wear out. So you get a hyperinsulinemia, and then it's followed by hypoinsulinemia, and then diabetes. I have in my possession, on my computer at home, 2 years ago, a position paper printed by the American College of Endocrinologists, which states one of the best way to treat diabetes type 2 is a vegan plant-based diet. And the reason is what I just told you. There is branched chain amino acids in what we call plants and fruits and vegetables, but they are not accessible to the body. They tend to be bound with the fiber. So you don't get very much of them. You get just enough to satisfy what you need. Mm-hmm. Because you need branched chain amino acids, because you don't produce them. So mTOR is what is really turned on in a fetus or on a zygote and then onto a, a fetus. And in young children who are growing, mTOR is working because it's driving the cells to divide. And what happens when you get cancer is the cells go back to the way you were in the womb with a fetus. They get active and they go crazy. Mechanistic target of rapamycin. That's the same stuff that they put in, by the way, to drug-eluting stents that go in the coronary artery. It's a rapamycin-like drug that inhibits mTOR so that you don't get fibroblasts there that causes scarring. So, the reasons for being vegan, if you want to get to the biochemistry level, are not just overwhelming, they're total and complete. There is no argument that you can give other than, I live in a place where I can only eat meat and therefore I would die if I didn't eat it. Then I would agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. Then you need to. And I've even had discussions with evolutionists who say, well, a paleo diet, I says, that's a bunch of baloney. I said, the reason you feel better on a paleo diet is they have no processed sugar, which is probably the number one poison in the world today. And you have no dairy. And so, of course, you're going to feel better. But you're loading yourself up with neuraminic acid 5-GC, which in the end is still going to give you atherosclerotic heart disease and cancer, hypertension, and diabetes, because guess what? Meat is loaded in branched chain amino acids, and there is no fiber. Yeah.
Now that you mentioned the sugar,
sugar becomes alcohol. I mean, there's evidence that people that eat, you know, these sugars, they develop the same, you know, fatty.
It's called fatter liver. You know why you get that? You get that from fructose. High fructose corn syrup. And the reason is fructose is only broken down in the liver. Sucrose is broken down in the bloodstream and in the cells. But fructose cannot be broken down there. And so what happens is there's a zero elimination. There's a first order and a second order elimination, if you remember from pharmacology and how you... fructose is a zero, which means it's arithmetic. It is not exponential. And so it's easily saturated. So what happens is your body takes that fructose syrup and stores it as fat till the liver can get to it.
But then it works, does it behave then like alcohol? And when you were talking earlier about, you know, how the alcohol works with the meat.
I don't know exactly if sugar drives alcohol, but I do know this, that if you read certain guys, like the guy by the name of Lestig, L-E-S-T-I-G, yes, who's from San Francisco, who's a pediatric endocrinologist. I've read a number of things and I listened to a couple of his lectures, and he thinks that processed sugar is, and I'm saying this carefully, is an agent of Satan. He doesn't say that, he's an atheist, but he does everything bad. But it's addictive as anything.
He calls it alcohol without the buzz.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. I've seen some of this.
And it's very addictive. Yeah. It's a Delta Phosphate, loves it and will push it. Watch someone, and I was a sugar addict. Mm-hmm. I'm embarrassed. I don't want to, you know, this isn't a tell-all. So I won't tell-all, but I'm going to tell you, I, in my earlier life, was terrible on my body. Horrible. I would eat Oreo cookies for breakfast. And that was my breakfast. Okay? What?
Coca-Cola and potato chips is vegan.
That is right.
Top it off with a little few Oreos. Or I would see people walking, or if I saw a bowl of candy when I was in medical school, when I was up on the floors, I didn't pass one of them without coming by two or three times, only stopped for fear of someone saying, hey, leave something for the rest of the people. All right? I believe that when you went to a meeting, to a meal, especially a potluck, you always started with a dessert. You didn't want to fill up on anything less. And then if you had anything left over, you'd go all the other way. I was terrible. I was an addict. Plain and simple. I needed it when I got up in the morning, and I wanted it at night before I went to bed. And with God's help, I broke it. And I don't have, but I'm always an addict. I know if I go back and start on it, I'm done.
So, I don't want you to spend a long time on this, but do you have anything to say about these hyper-sweetened sugar substitutes, right? Because a tiny little bit of that stimulates a higher sugar response than sugar does, and yet the world's, you know, going crazy.
Well, it first of all, it plays into the addiction, so it doesn't help it. But the other thing with those sweeteners is there's not a one of them that either can't be metabolized by the body, or once it is, it's metabolized in some very bad things like cyanide-containing molecules when you drink Diet Coke, things of that nature. They're bad metabolites, and some of them are carcinogenic, oncogenic. So I've heard over and over again that you're much better off eating the sugar, the processed sugar, than eating the sweeteners.
Stevia?
I don't know about it in particular. Is it the one that's the plant-based one? I have not read about it, so I'm going to say until I've had a chance to read about it.
It, you know, it's not normally you can buy it, you know, as a green powder, but then it comes white. I worry about what is all this processing doing to the actual.
Yeah, I mean, white table sugar, sucrose, is 50% fructose.
Yes.
And high fructose corn syrup is 55% fructose.
Right. But you can't break it's hard to for your body to metabolize the high fructose. It will send it to the liver primarily.
Right, the same thing with the sucrose, though. Yeah. Even though you split it, you still have almost the same amount of fructose that you need to metabolize.
So, anyway, and I was loath to get rid of the sugar, I must admit to you. Ellen White makes a statement, which I read, which was one of my propelling motivators. She said that when she goes to Adventist potlucks, that the amount of desserts dwarfs the amount of good food, and the amount of desserts that is that are imbibed do more damage to the body than if the person ate meat. And I know what meat does. There's a lot of people who are holier than thou that say, oh, I'm vegetarian. I get all the blessings. Oh, by the way, I'll have all of this apple pie and some of this chocolate cake. I better get them right now quickly before other people come in line. And I'm putting a chocolate chip cookie in my mouth as I'm running back to the table. And that's true. You've seen it. I know I was one of them. I just described myself. That's how I was able to give so accurate a picture. You know, and I wonder if Ellen White makes another statement, and now it haunts me, and that is, if you do not take care of your body, God will hold you responsible for the time you could have lived on and the work you could have done and you didn't do. And I know I'm going to have some splaining to do. But I'm also claiming ignorance, because at the time I was doing it, I knew nothing of what I knew now. Once I got to know the truth, I stopped. But I wonder what damage was done. And some of you may say, well, we can look at you and tell. We're not going to say anything, but it's there. Mm-hmm. I agree. I know. I have no defense. So, look, I hate to be blunt, but I'm going to be. Salvation is a chemical issue. It's physical. And when Ellen White says the health message is the right arm, I'm going to make another statement. This is off the record. We stopped the recording at this point. Ellen White makes the statement that meat eaters will not be translated. She does say that.
It's not off the record, then. It's in her record.
Well, I know, but where I'm going next is off the record. I believe that the 144,000 will only be made up of vegans. And that's not arbitrary on God's part, because he has a checklist. And he says, veganism, that's number two. Okay, you get to be there. It's because you're unfit. You can't get the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, which is going to prepare you to stand through that time, to seal you, and to prepare you for Christ to come. If you've got neuraminic acid 5GC all over and you've got an inflamed body, I have one paper where it shows a 25-year-old or 23-year-old was in an automobile accident, and at the post, the person went in, and I don't know how they got permission to do it, but they flayed open the aorta, and I will go through the chemical means, but they were able to determine if there were any of the person's own antibodies that were attached to the aorta because of neuraminic acid 5GC, okay? And the thing lit up because they radioactively labeled it with phosphorus PO4. The whole thing was brightly colored. So every time you drink dairy or every time you eat red meat, you are making a huge inflammatory reaction throughout your vasculature. Is there any wonder that you get this response in your brain, the blood flow to your brain? Why do you get carotid disease? This all is it fits in. So I believe that the health message is the right arm of the gospel, and the reason is, what can you do if you're right-handed and you don't have a right arm and your left doesn't work very well? It can't get you to where you want to, what you want to do and where you want to be. If salvation were not a physical issue, diet would not carry the weight Ellen White has given to it. She would have gone overboard on it. But if it is a physical issue, then everything she said is very germane and ought to be taken seriously. And what do I hear now in my own church in Dayton, Ohio? And I won't say which one. There's five, so you're going to be left to guess. That the things we shouldn't judge other people on are diet. You know, if they want to eat meat and they like to eat, you know, if you're not vegan, they sneer. That's no reason for you to be deciding. And a recent paper came out, and I can't remember where I read it right now, stating that a majority of Adventists now are not vegetarian, much less vegan. 52% are omnivores. At least 52%. We're going toward the flesh pots of Egypt. We've turned around and we're headed back. Because people say that was an old misguided rule. Ellen White, bless her heart, was a very Christian woman, but she had some strange ideas, and she was a complete product of her time. And this, you know, Kellogg had got to her, and it has nothing to do with whether God forgives you or not. But you see, Christ forgave everyone at the cross, and Ellen White says that was for all humanity. So we're all working up, trying to ask for forgiveness, and that's already been granted. That's not the problem. But the devil is happy for us to work and churn and spend all of our time making sure that all of the books in heaven say we're forgiven, which, by the way, you can't keep up with all of the miscues you have up there, so you're going to miss some. Yeah, that's when I was a little boy, I used to lay at night and worry about that, and I'd get down and pray for all the sins I forgot to ask for forgiveness for. And then I thought, well, God's smart. Why would he buy that? Because I'm going to do those again tomorrow. The answer is you've got to be changed. Salvation has nothing to do with forgiveness. It has to do with change. It has to do with remaking you back to where you have to be. That's what the whole thing's about. And we're crouched over here. Well, it only has to do with forgiveness. And these rules are extrinsic, meaning they are not built into the system. Therefore, God knows I'm a good person. He knows I'm a good Joe. He knows that I went out on Sabbath afternoon. I gave tracts, and I used to go in gathering. I got more money than anyone else. And I helped the family down the street, and I even mowed their lawn. Those are all good and laudable, but they aren't going to get you where you need to be. You have to be changed so that you wouldn't even mention the fact that you mowed the lawn to your neighbor because you wanted to do it to help him. And that's why when he comes and he says, well, he says, this group, you fed me when I was hungry, you clothed me when I was naked, you visited me in prison. And they'll say, we didn't. No, we didn't. We have no memory of doing that at all. And Christ says, yeah, but when you did it here, and they said, oh, no, that doesn't count. We were doing that because we wanted to. That was something we were doing for us, not for you. That doesn't count. That shouldn't be brought in the equation. The exact opposites to the other group. The other group says, here's a list of what we did. I went to help feed. I went to the food pantry. You saw that religiously every week for 10 years. And Christ says, get away from me. I don't even know you. Because it has nothing to do with actions per se. Actions just validate what's going on. Faith is the substance of things unseen, the evidence of things hoped for. So we've got to get to realize what we're dealing with here, bluntly again, is a terminal genetic disease that was brought in the fruit of the the knowledge tree of knowledge of good and evil, which before you came in, I brought that name. Why would we get that tree named knowledge of good and evil? Because Adam and Eve only knew good before. How did you get to know evil? There was the architect for changing their subconscious into the terrible stuff. And I talked about Charles Whitman, who committed all those horrific things in 1966 at the University of Houston from the tower, and that he said, I don't know. He went for help to psychiatrists. He went, no one would help him. And he said, I'm being overpowered here. Something's happening. Something's wrong. And I'm bequeathing my brain and my body to this University of Texas Medical School because something's wrong. You need to find out what's wrong in me to keep it from happening in others. And sure enough, he had a glioblastoma that was blocking his neocortex from communicating with his limbic system, and his limbic system went wild unchecked. Well, how did his limbic system get bad? What programmed it in there for him to kill his wife and his mother and then 13 people and injure 33 others, strangers? And he didn't want to do it. You read his diary, he says, I'm losing it. These impulses are becoming beyond my capability to resist. He went to a family physician. He went to a psychiatrist. They told him he'd be okay. Where did this drive to do these evil things come from? Who put the programming in there to do that? It had to come from somewhere. And why is it always bad? Yes. I don't know.
Why don't you get an impulse to do that?
Or I told the truth all day today. I just had this overwhelming, I had to tell the truth.
Why is that? It's ridiculous.
Just like Carrie in that when he has to tell the truth for, he's a lawyer. And I forget I saw it many, many years ago, Jim Carrey, and he's forced to tell the truth. Something happens and he's forced to tell the truth and he can hardly speak in court because he's used to lying and changing things. Why don't we have those compulsions?
Right.
Or make other people feel good. I just can't stop today. I'm just making everyone feel good. Mm-hmm. It's never good, ever. It's always bad. It's always selfish. It's always about me. Always, always. Not 98%, not 99. It's 100, period. Well, Ellen White calls it the lower passions or the lower parts of the brain which have taken over. Let me give you one other illustration and I'll give you what your answer is. If you go to game theory, well, I love game theory. I've read game theory. There's a great book and I forgot the name of it right now, so don't ask it to me. I'm tired. When it comes to this time at night, my memory is not that good anyway, but it gets really bad. Game theory shows that there's a game called the Prisoner's Dilemma, and I'm not going to go through the whole game right now. But I will tell you that it's been tested around the world. Every culture and ethnicity, and the results are everybody is selfish. They play the game to beat out someone else, to win. Even with cooperating, it becomes clear to them that they will win something and the other side will win something and everybody will be good. They will take the chance that their small chance that they will win and get everything, knowing very well they will lose and get nothing, and that the other person won't get anything either. They always make that choice. Why? Why not make the choice and say, hey, we both get something? I didn't walk in here with anything. I'm going to walk out here with something more than I came in with. But you see, there's all kinds of things going on, like someone else getting what you do. You want to get more than they do. You want to be number one. You want everything for yourself. You want to do something. There's all kinds of reasons. Why is that through every culture, everywhere you look? Why don't we come to some areas, pockets where these people are just altruistic? They whatever to help the others. And they say, no, give it to them. You don't find that. You just don't find it. It's not there. No, the 3-year-olds are your worst if you want to be selfish. So, well, here's my answer. It's probably one that you can't tell many people, but the fact is the devil has set up circuitry in your limbic system, which is geared toward selfishness or self-preservation at the cost of all else.
Unless we have armedpastors.com.
You know what I'd say to that? And I, you know, maybe it's easy for me to say right now. But I would hope that we, I'm going to tell you a story. David Small told me, he's a very good friend of mine. He's the son of Carol Small, who was a pathologist. He's back in Dayton. They're very, probably some of my closest friends that I have back there. He's a retired surgeon. And he tells a story that he went for 5 years to Monte Morelos, where he was a missionary. And another missionary came to came from to spend some time in Mexico. And he said, I want to get up and reach this tribe. And it was in the mountain area. And he says, I need to get up there. I want to reach this tribe. No one's gotten up there and reached them yet. And I want to take the message. He was kind of like a paramedic, so he could do medical things. And the reason David Small knew about him is this guy drove this old beat up white Ford station wagon that he would drive up there. And if there was really sick villagers, he would put them in the car. Now, he could only go up when it wasn't rainy season. When it was rainy season, the mud was so thick he couldn't get up there. So he would take his car up only select times of the year, and it was up high. So what he would do is he would drive up there, and he'd spend 3 or 4 days, maybe five. He would try to do the easy medical things he could do, pull teeth, whatever, and then he'd come down, and there was different villages he would go to. And I forgot the name of the Indians that David Swall told me, the tribe. He told me this. And he said one time the guy went to a new village he'd never been to before, and he stayed 5 days, and he got up to leave on the fifth day. And one of the villagers came up to him, and he said, sir, may I ask you a question? And the guy said, yes. He goes, we've looked everywhere, and we can't find where those four white policemen, one on each side of your car, on all four sides, all night we see them standing there guarding your car, and in the morning we can't find them. Where do they go? Where do you hide them? I'd rather have four policemen that are white, shiny, that's what he meant, standing and watching me that night when I sleep than my own gun in my house. Because I might be too sleepy and what, maybe a bad shot, and why would I be then killing someone anyway? Isn't it true that what happens to me, God allows to happen to me? Unless I go in an area where I've not been sanctioned to go? And isn't that what Paul said? Yeah, they can't kill me. And what did Christ say? It's not my time. And he had multiple attempts on his life. We only know a couple of them, but Ellen White said they were always looking for a way to kill him. It's easy for me to stay here tonight because I don't have an imminent threat, but while I'm sitting here and just thinking rationally, I would much prefer that I leave the safety problems up to him. Because if I'm not to get into trouble, I won't. And he's got 100% way of keeping it from happening, and with the best equipment, guns, arms, whatever, and alarms, I'm probably 70% if I'm lucky. And what happens when I walk out in the morning? I said, phew, I made it through the night, and they're waiting in the bushes. Boom, I'm done. Or my car blows up. The way I'm trying to look at it is, if my job here is done, then let's get it over with. If I'm supposed to do something more, show me what it is and preserve me so I can do it. I read to you Isaiah 57:1 before. People are very, these are my paraphrase, people are very concerned about the righteous that die, but they're taken away to save them from the evil to come. We talked about Hezekiah. No Manasseh. If he would have agreed to go when the time was, God said, get your house in order, you're going to die. And he said, this is some thanks you give me after I stood up for you and when the Assyrians came and Sennacherib, and I put my life on the line literally in torture, and this is the things I get? God says, okay, I'll give you 15 years more. But you're going to see it wasn't a good choice. So, well, 9 o'clock. Clearly, time to be out of here.
We were done around 7:30.
Amazing. Thank
you. I'm telling Webster that I was done between 7:30 and 7:45 and that I was kept against my will. They locked the door and wouldn't let me out.